This Week in Palestine offers news, information, and culture from Palestinian perspectives. The following hour may contain views that do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. Good morning if you're tuning in to WZBC Radio, and welcome to all of our podcast listeners. My name is Sophia Rose Wollman. Today is May 4th, 2025, and you're listening to This Week in Palestine.
She framed the world in shattered light. A rebel with a lens in hand. Each click a protest, each flash of fight.
This is the truth, do you understand?
The bombs would fall, the children cried, but she stood steady in the smoke. Her camera, her shield, her anger, her guide.
I'll show you the life that they broke.
Oh, Fatima, your eyes still sees what the killers tried to bury deep in the rubble and the refugees' plea. Your photographs won't let the world sleep. We see you and we hear your scream. Your camera, your shield, your anger, your guide. Your camera, your shield, you're still alive. Your anger is our anger. They silenced the sirens, they banned the press. But she smuggled the proof in pixels and grace. Till the airstrike came with its cruel address.
No witnesses left in this place.
You said it clear, they can't defeat us because we have nothing to lose.
They can't defeat us, they won't defeat us. We have nothing to lose.
The last shot blurred, a sky torn in two. Her body curled round her camera tight. They can burn the film, but the light shines through.
Her truth is the dawn after night.
You won't let the world sleep.
Faith in
what we see you and we hear your scream. Your camera, your shield, your anger, your guide. Your camera, your shield, you're still.
You're listening to This Week in Palestine on WZBC. Today, we'll hear Yusuf Munayyer in a recording of his presentation, Palestine in the Time of Monsters, and the conversation that follows between him and Sarah Ann Minkin during the New Jewish Left Conference, which was sponsored by Boston University's Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs on February 28, 2025. But first, a story from Democracy Now!
We begin today's show in Vermont, where Columbia University student and Palestinian activist Mohsen Mahdawi was released after more than 2 weeks in U.S. immigration custody. Mahdawi is a green card holder from Palestine who was born and raised in a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. He was arrested on April 14th when he appeared for what he was told would be a citizenship interview. Mahdawi had participated in the Palestinian solidarity protests at Columbia last year. He was also president of the Columbia University Buddhist Association. He was freed on bail on Wednesday by U.S. District Judge Jeffrey Crawford, who criticized the Trump administration's handling of the case. In his ruling, Crawford wrote that Mahdawi had made, quote, substantial claims that his detention is the result of a retaliation for protected speech that he engaged in as a college student on the Columbia campus. Crawford went on to write, quote, the court also considers the extraordinary setting of this case and others like it. Legal residents not charged with crimes or misconduct are being arrested and threatened with deportation for stating their views on the political issues of the day. Our nation has seen times like this before, especially during the Red Scare and Palmer raids of 1919-1920 that led to the deportation of hundreds of people suspected of anarchist or communist views, Crawford wrote.
After Mohsen Mahdawi left the federal courthouse in Burlington, Vermont, he addressed supporters.
And we send a clear message as well that if we have faith in our beliefs, unshakable beliefs, which is the belief that justice is inevitable. Mm-hmm. Yes. We will not fear anyone because our fight is a fight for love, is a fight for democracy, is a fight for humanity. Amen. Yes. And I am saying it clear and loud.
Yes.
To President Trump and his cabinet.
Yes.
I am not afraid of you. Yes! Never give up on the idea that justice will prevail and that we have to come together to bring our voices and our hearts and raise them. Not only for America, not only for this system of democracy that has checks and balances, and this court is part of it, but also for our humanity. We have to restore and reform the international order and abide by international law as a first step towards justice. We must stand up for humanity because the rest of the world, not only Palestine, is watching us. And what is going to happen in America is going to affect the rest of the world.
That's right. Yeah.
I will end up by saying to my people in Palestine, I feel your pain. I see you suffering. And I see the freedom. And it is very, very soon. Yeah. Free, free Palestine.
Columbia University student and Palestinian activist Mohsen Mahdawi, speaking in Burlington, Vermont, Wednesday after he was freed after over 2 weeks in an immigration jail.
In our next segment on This Week in Palestine, we will feature Yusuf Munayyer's presentation, Palestine in the Time of Monsters, and the conversation that follows between him and Sarah Ann Minkin during the New Jewish Left Conference at Boston University's Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs, which took place on February 28, 2025.
Today, I am so happy to introduce our speaker, Yusuf Munayyer. He is a prolific scholar, current head of the Palestinian Israel Program, and senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, D.C. Our discussion for this session is Sarah Ann Minkin. Without further ado, let's give a warm round of applause to our panelists.
Thank you all for being here today. To Jeremy and the organizers of this important conference for holding this discussion, and thanks to my fellow presenters and colleagues here today. I look forward to engaging with you today. We're witnessing a moment of profound change around the globe, and in the Middle East in particular. The past 16 months of genocide in Gaza take place in the context of these shifts. I will frame my comments today along the observation of Antonio Gramsci in Understanding Interregnums, or intermediary periods between more clearly defined eras. He wrote, "The old world is dying, the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters." First, what is the old world? A hegemonic system that developed over years in the last century of liberal internationalism that posited, in a general sense, that rights trump the naked politics of power. From the Treaty of Versailles to the collapse of empires to the death and destruction of the Second World War to the institutions and agreements forged in its wake, a series of events led to a set of rules, not rulers, that was to keep order. The Fourth Geneva Convention was agreed to. The Convention Against Genocide was agreed to. The United Nations was formed to prevent a recurrence of world war and a clash of nuclear powers. International law, and at its very core, the recognition of the sovereignty of nations and its fundamental sanctity, was to put an end to the land grabs and aggression that led to one historic conflagration after the other. But it was not to last. It's hard to point to an exact moment when the decline of this old order began, but it likely accelerated in the period of American unipolarity after the Cold War. The old order sustained through decades of nuclear tensions between superpowers, or perhaps we sustained through decades of nuclear tensions between superpowers because of the old order. That possibility is enough to earn it credit. But as the Cold War came to an end, and as the United States, which had been a leading advocate in forming this order, enjoyed a period of unrivaled power, the order itself began to show its limits. The American war on Iraq, a horrific and destabilizing war hypocritically packaged by Washington as an endeavor for freedom, democracy, and human rights, was perhaps the most significant catalyst in the order's decline. In the years that followed, Western tolerance for strongmen against popular uprisings that sought genuine democratic change led to wars and refugees, which would further test the West's commitment to rights and values over interests. The result has been a wave of right-wing nativist and isolationist parties gaining power. Now, it's important to note here that Israel has always been in tension with this order to a certain degree. At its founding, there was the complete disregard for the self-determination of Palestinians, followed by the thorough ethnic cleansing of the Nakba, all while Israel adopted the UN Declaration of Human Rights and was granted full membership into the international body. The dissonance was apparent, perhaps most clearly for Palestinians and then for the decolonizing world, while Western powers were most comfortable turning a blind eye. So maybe it is fitting then that Israel, that flimsy stone laid at the foundational stage of this post-war order, plays such a prominent role during its ultimate demise. During the Biden administration, which came into power claiming to put, quote, human rights at the center of its foreign policy, its hypocritical support for Israel was accentuated by its desire to push Russia back in Ukraine while standing with European allies. At the same time that the Biden administration was speaking of international law violations in Ukraine, it was funding them in Gaza. While it welcomed ICC decisions against Putin, it condemned ICC decisions against Netanyahu. While it mobilized international support in diplomatic forums like the United Nations to isolate Russia, it isolated itself with veto after veto to keep Israel's genocidal army on the march. Skeptics of the international order had long understood it to be an instrument of power rather than an instrument to constrain power. But the blatant hypocrisy of the Biden administration, which was made more insulting with every smirk from Matt Miller and every tear from John Kirby, turned skeptics into the majority. The hegemony of the order had shattered. Enter Donald Trump. Unlike Biden, who pretended to care for a rules-based order while funding genocide, Trump doesn't even bother with the pretending. He skipped straight to the imperialist endeavor of annexing Greenland and the Panama Canal, tariff wars, and gutting birthright citizenship. He's removed even the most minor American sanctions on Israeli settlers precisely as they rampage more violently through the West Bank, and he threatens to sanction international courts and any who help hold Israeli war criminals accountable. If the old order began with diplomatic conventions around protecting civilians in wartime, it has died with corporate billionaires who rushed to test their AI products with the Israeli military on the children of Gaza, standing behind the, quote, leader of the free world at his inauguration. And so what is the new world that is struggling to be born? The truth is we don't know, and there might be some time before we find out. We see the signs of it, however, in the contentious politics of this moment. We see signs of it on the college campuses across the West, which have erupted in protest and erected encampments to dissent from the policies that support the genocide. We see it dressed in the lawyerly robes before the International Court of Justice. We see signs of it in the opinion polls. We see it on social media, and we see it in the sumud of Palestinians in Gaza. Perhaps we will see much more of it when Western journalists finally make their way into Gaza and report to their audiences the extent of the barbarity carried out by the Israeli military there. But the old doesn't die easy, and importantly, it fights hardest on its way out. Gramsci tells us that the power of cultural hegemony is that it is so widely accepted that it is not questioned and not even noticed. It's just the way things are. When ideas have reached a degree of hegemonic acceptance, they wield power without coercion. It's when hegemony shakes, when many begin questioning the validity of the current order, that coercion becomes increasingly necessary for maintaining a grip on power. This is precisely the stage that we are in as Trump comes to power in the United States again. For several years now, we've been in a situation in the United States where public opinion on U.S. support for Israel has shifted in a more critical direction. What was once unquestioned has come to be routinely questioned at the popular level among large swaths of the American public. Two key prior catalysts for the shift were the Israeli wars on Gaza in 2008 and 2009, and the war on Gaza in 2014. You can imagine the sort of impact 16 months of genocide will have compared to these prior wars, which lasted a matter of weeks. Realizing this, the forces seeking to maintain U.S. support for Israel, chiefly the Israeli government and its allied partners in the United States, began efforts to crack down on activism and dissent against U.S. policy. In the words of Israeli government officials, when it came to responding to global activism calling out Israeli abuses, it was time to, quote, shift from defense to offense. The earliest stages of this saw the drafting and passage of anti-BDS laws in the United States, followed by intense lawfare, and then the passage of anti-Semitism definitions across various governments and institutions regulating speech and imposing crackdowns for those that failed to comply. But as children were being slaughtered in Gaza, masses of Americans, particularly but not exclusively from its younger generation, took to the streets and their campus greens to protest and demand the end of the genocide. Many American Zionists were shocked by the scale, scope, and speed of this mobilization, in part because they believed that the events of October 7th would create greater empathy for Israel as the victim. But such an outcome relied on a narrative context that Israel itself had been destroying with every bomb they've dropped on Gaza over the last 20 years. Thus, the effort to organize a crackdown went into overdrive. The Israeli newspaper Yediot Ahronot reported in November of 2023 that Israeli ministries working with the pro-Israel American philanthropists sought to coordinate pressure campaigns on American universities. University presidents were summoned before Congress to be berated and embarrassed in show trials and were later forced to resign. Lawsuits from dutiful Zionist lawfare actors sought to compel universities to crack down further, alleging discrimination. Police were called onto our campuses to violently break up encampments in massively publicized instances at Columbia, UCLA, and elsewhere, even though the vast, vast majority of protest activity was peaceful, and the vast majority of violence recorded at such protests were instigated by counter-protesters. Campus was just one place where this repression took place. Congress teed up all sorts of repressive legislation as well, including some that will likely pass this year, targeting the ICC, UN agencies, and NGOs who challenge the pro-Israel line. At the political level, pro-Israel interest groups have invested more money in shaping U.S. politics than ever before. AIPAC alone spent a record amount on congressional races, targeting progressive Democrats who spoke out about Israel. Hundreds of millions of dollars were spent by pro-Israel donors to elect Trump, including $100 million from Miriam Adelson alone. All of this is emblematic of the top-down power plays that characterize the coercive era we are in as hegemony shakes. Students protest genocide? No problem. Demand university administrators arrest them. If the administrators don't cooperate, fine. Withdraw donations and drag them before Congress. Is there dissent in Congress? Okay. Spend historic sums to unseat critics and intimidate others. Social media platforms permit dissent on Palestine? Then just demand that they adhere to pro-Israel speech codes and drag them before Congress or shut them down if they don't. All of this repression is happening because it is required to cling to a crumbling status quo for as long as possible. While I ultimately believe this will backfire as people will increasingly recognize it for the naked and desperate coercion that it is, it's not clear how long that may take, and pro-Israel forces remain committed to pressing on further. Now in the White House, they have an ally who speaks of ethnically cleansing millions of people as if he's rearranging his sock drawers. And so this is the time of monsters. As we move away from an era where rights and norms have value to something else, the interregnum is defined by power being the only value that matters. So what does this mean for Palestinians at this moment? While there are numerous implications here, I want to focus on a crucial one that is also particularly important for this audience to understand. The Iron Wall is failing. Jabotinsky's essay, which turned a century old about a month after October 7th, 2023, is often cited for many things. Its importance as a shaper of Israeli ideology and strategy, its characterization of Zionism as a colonial enterprise, its unapologetic commitment to violence as a necessity, among others. But here I want to talk about an aspect of the Iron Wall which is just as important and perhaps more so in this moment, the aspect of hope. Jabotinsky was opposed to an agreement with the Arabs of Palestine at the time. He understood that they were a native people, that Zionists should expect Palestinian resistance, and that this was merely the only natural course the confrontation between Zionism and Palestinians could take. And yet, he imagined an eventual agreement. Even if an agreement was not possible a century ago, in his vision, there existed a threshold of violence over time beyond which the Arabs, as he called them, a living people, would essentially give up and concede to an agreement with Zionism. Mere paragraphs before this, he wrote, "Colonization, I quote, can have only one aim, and Palestine Arabs cannot accept this aim. It lies in the very nature of things, and in this particular regard, nature cannot be changed." And yet he is able to leap from that conclusion to the conclusion that an agreement will eventually be possible. How can this be? Hope, a naive hope for sure, that somehow this circle can be squared. But this hope is also vital for the Zionist project itself. The project is not merely an idea on paper, but a material reality that requires people, many of them, to remain committed to it. That commitment, in turn, if it is to sustain over time, requires a belief not just that great sacrifices for the project are worthy, but also that at some point, it will no longer be necessary to sacrifice greatly for the project. A century after the Iron Wall's publication, that horizon has never seemed further away. On October 7th, despite being besieged, repeatedly bombarded, and far outmatched conventionally, stateless Palestinians from Gaza inflicted the most significant losses on Israel in decades. What followed from the Israeli military was genocidal-level violence, the likes of which we had not previously seen in this context. All of this is happening at a tremendously vulnerable moment in time in Israeli society, which was locked in a battle over the very nature of its existence between a more secular Zionist wing that is increasingly bearing the burdens of state militarism while dwindling in numbers, and a more religious wing which is reaping the state's benefits and rapidly growing as a proportion of the population. Despite unprecedented levels of violence, we do not seem to be on the cusp of Jabotinsky's eventual agreement. Here I want to recall another section of the essay, perhaps the most important not for what it states, but for what it doesn't. And that is the section on whether Zionism is, quote, moral and just. Either Zionism is moral and just, Jabotinsky writes, or it is immoral and unjust. But that is a question that we should have settled before we became Zionists. Actually, we've settled that question, and in the affirmative. We hold that Zionism is moral and just, and since it is moral and just, justice must be done, no matter what Joseph or Simon or Ivan or Ahmed agree with it or not. There is no other morality. That's it. No room for introspection. No room for rethinking the project. No way to go but through those who object. If violent coercion does not lead to them accepting their subjugation, as Jabotinsky had hoped, what then, if anything can be done in support of this project? What then, if there is, as he wrote, no other morality? There's only elimination. This is the stage we are in now. The choice that Zionist discourse has centered on is not the choice the late Jimmy Carter had once famously laid out in the title of his book, Peace or Apartheid. Rather, it is a choice between apartheid or genocide and ethnic cleansing. I could go through a list of statements from officials, opinion shapers, and other Zionist leaders calling for genocide or ethnic cleansing in recent months and years, but this crowd is probably familiar with them. We've arrived at an intersection where Zionist discourse has overwhelmingly ruled out Palestinian self-determination, while simultaneously realizing how naive the Iron Wall's hope for an agreement through coercion was, and all at the same time as international conditions have never been more supportive of Zionist militancy. This is a monstrous time indeed. Palestinians will have plenty to say about this, and you will see it in their resistance in various forms, but it is not enough. We must all ask ourselves what steps we are taking to prevent the destruction of Palestinians as we stand at that precipice. We must ask ourselves this question now so that our children and grandchildren will not have to ask us why we failed. Thank you.
Here you are speaking to this very motivated audience of the Jewish left. You ended by telling us there are steps we need to take for the sake of how we can answer to the next generation, who we're already answering to. And I want to ask you to tell us those steps.
Well, thank you for that. It's funny, over lunch somebody asked me a similar question about being at this particular conference and so on, and what it means to be a Palestinian speaking to this audience. And I don't only think about it in those terms. I also think about the fact that as an American citizen sitting in a room with many American citizens who care about this issue, we have a unique responsibility to address our complicity and our government's complicity in the genocide.
Thank you.
And I will speak in every room like that that is available. I also think that there are overlaps, for sure. We've talked about these themes throughout the day. I wanted to frame my discussion around the changing global order because I think, yes, Palestinians are uniquely threatened by this, but we are by far not the only people who are threatened by this. We may be the weakest at the moment among other stateless people who are next on the chopping block, but it doesn't stop with us. Yeah. And if there is one overriding lesson in Jewish history, it's that systems without laws and rules that protect minority and the rights of others and that rely just on the law of the jungle, that doesn't work out very well, not least for minorities like the Jews of the world or Palestinians or anyone else. So that's where I see the clearest intersections. This is there is, of course, a struggle for Palestinian freedom. That is a unique struggle, but it is also part and parcel of an effort to create a world where people are genuinely protected regardless to, what their religion is, what their ethnicity is. And we're moving further and further away from that by the day. And it feels that things are accelerating. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to underscore the urgency of this. You're right to recall Omer's comments as he was talking. I was nodding along a lot. I think we're at a place today in Palestine that is very, very grave. I hope and pray that it doesn't go in this direction. But the analyst in me, the realist in me, sees that as an increasingly likely possibility, that we may soon see violence directed at Palestinians that makes the last year and a half pale in comparison. But we need to be very clear-eyed about this threat, right? It's hard to kind of wrap our heads around. So I think it calls for a level of engagement and activism and work that is beyond what we've been willing to do before, what we've been comfortable doing before, and something that is grounded in that urgency. I would love to see the kind of change that we all want to see here in the United States and on the global stage happen quickly. It may not. It may be a longer project in the making. I don't know that Palestinians have the time to wait for that to happen, especially with everything that is arrayed against them at this time. So there needs to be a really unique focus on trying to change U.S. policy, U.S. support for Israel, and obviously the Jewish American community here plays a very important and unique role in shaping U.S. policy. And I don't need to explain that to anyone in this room. We all see it, we all understand how it works. In whatever ways that you can affect that, that you can change that, that you can improve that, commit to that more than you've ever committed before, because it's needed now in an urgent way. You know, I think at the moment, it seems that Palestinians are most focused on survival through this stage. Mm-hmm. The kind of threats facing Palestinians today are not at the order of magnitude that they have been in the past. And this is escalating on all fronts. And I want to really emphasize the fissures in Israeli society right now and the direction that it is taking, because as things break down, and if and should they accelerate in breaking down, the first victims in the chaos that will be targeted will be Palestinians.
Yes.
And so this is, I think, the primary focus for Palestinians at this moment, and it's hard to think beyond that given the reality that they.
This is This Week in Palestine on WZBC Radio. You've just been hearing from Yusef Munayer's presentation on Palestine in the Time of Monsters and his discussion with Sarah Ann Menken at the New Jewish Left Conference at Boston University's Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs on February 28th, 2025. We turn now to portions of Democracy Now! Aired on May 2nd, 2025.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Nermeen Sheikh with Amy Goodman in Baltimore. An update on Badr Khan Suri, the Georgetown University professor and postdoctoral scholar who was arrested in March by masked federal agents outside of his home in Virginia. He had a hearing Thursday before a Biden-appointed judge who gave Trump officials 24 hours to provide details on when they decided to move Suri across at least five ICE facilities to an ICE jail in Texas, where he remains separated from his wife, who's a U.S. citizen of Palestinian descent, and his three children. We're joined now by Mary Bauer, executive director of the ACLU of Virginia, and Nadir Hashemi, professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at Georgetown University and director of the center where Badr Khan Suri was hired as a postdoctoral fellow, Georgetown Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding. Welcome both to Democracy Now! Nadir Hashemi, if we could begin with you. You very recently went to visit Badr Khan Suri in the ICE detention facility where he now is in Texas. If you could tell us about that visit.
Well, I went to visit him because since his arrest on March the 17th, no one had actually gone down to meet him. So I figured out where he was. I called the detention facility and I was able to meet him, but of course not face to face. One of the shocking things that I learned when I went to the ICE detention facility was that Barakhan Suri has been designated by the Department of Homeland Security as a high security, high risk threat prisoner. So he has restricted rights in the detention facility. He only gets 2 hours of fresh air a week. There are constant roll calls to determine his presence in the prison. And you're not able to meet high-risk prisoners face-to-face. So I had to speak with him through a window via an intercom telephone. You know, he told me about the conditions that were in that prison, and they were, you know, quite shocking and quite horrific. One of the things that I took away from the meeting was really his spirit of resistance. I wrote an essay on this topic that people can look up and find more details, but Barakhan Suri was very adamant that the suffering and the pain that he has faced and that his family has been subjected to will be worth it if it helps expose, number one, the naked authoritarianism of the Trump administration, and number two, if his incarceration keeps the spotlight on the genocide on Gaza. So I was really touched by his willingness to fight back and to, you know, have his day in court and push back against the charges that have been directed against him by the Trump administration.
Mary Bauer, you're executive director of the ACLU of Virginia. If you can give us an update on what the judge said yesterday, and I know things are going to change over these next few days. Today is a deadline for the federal lawyers, tomorrow for Suri's lawyers. Explain why this Indian national, this postdoctoral graduate student and professor at Georgetown, was picked up to begin with, and what did the judge say?
Yes, Dr. Suri was picked up because he had spoken out for peace. He teaches peace. He was arrested very clearly because of his political view and family association. And that is fundamentally at odds with the values of American values. He was grabbed by masked agents without due process. He was sent more than 1,000 miles away after a series of detention facilities. We were very pleased with the judge's questions in court. They were very thoughtful questions, and they obviously sought to hold the government accountable and ask them, why was he moved repeatedly? Why was he taken out of Virginia? Why was he brought to a facility 1,000 miles away when there were beds in Virginia and he had to sleep on the floor in the facility in Texas? So there are real questions that the government is going to have to answer, and they only have until 5 o'clock today. So we are very much looking forward to seeing those answers so that we can respond.
Well, I'd like to go to Dr. Barakhan Suri's wife, Mahfez Saleh, who was speaking on Thursday outside the courthouse of the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia.
I am here today not just as the wife of the political prisoner Barakhan Suri. I speak for everyone who once believed that the United States stood for freedom and justice. On March 17th, masked federal agents abducted Barakhan outside our home in Virginia. His unjust and illegal arrest has turned our life upside down. Our three children have not seen their father for 44 days. They have only seen him on a screen wearing a red uniform used for those considered the most dangerous people in detention center. Our very young twins are not aware of what's going on. They just want their father to come back. But our oldest have a sense. He cries all the time and tries to hide his tears from his sibling.
In the Mediterranean, a ship carrying humanitarian aid for Gaza sent out a distress signal overnight after it was bombed by drones in international waters near Malta. The Freedom Flotilla Coalition, which organized the voyage, is blaming Israel for the attack, which set the ship on fire, punched a substantial breach in the hull, and cut off communication with those aboard. The Maltese government said 12 crew members and 4 civilians were confirmed safe after a nearby tug helped put out the flames. Dozens of international activists were preparing to board the boat and head to Gaza. Just before the broadcast, Democracy Now! Reached retired U.S. colonel and former State Department official Anne Wright, who was in Malta waiting to board the flotilla.
My name is Anne Wright, retired Army colonel, former U.S. diplomat, and I'm here in Malta with the Gaza Freedom Flotilla. And this morning early, just after midnight, two drones struck our Gaza Freedom ship called the Conscience that was in international waters off Malta. And if you remember, we've been sending ships to challenge the Israeli illegal naval blockade of Gaza since 2008. And actually, 15 years ago in 2010 was when the Mavi Marmara was attacked by the Israelis and 10 people killed and 50 wounded. I was on one of the smaller boats that were part of that flotilla. And since then, we've sent over 35 boats to challenge the Israeli blockade of Gaza. And now our flotilla is challenging not only that blockade that has kept all of the food and water and everything out of Gaza now for almost a month and a half, on the genocide that the U.S. is complicit of, the Israeli genocide of at least 55,000-60,000 Palestinians in Gaza, and then the ethnic cleansing of the West Bank. But right here, we are in Malta dealing with a brutal attack on an innocent ship, a ship that was at anchor or outside in territorial waters, waiting for us, the activists, to come on board so that we could then head toward Gaza to say to the world that here are some citizens that are willing to take action. Where our governments fail to act, we, the citizens, are trying to act to bring international attention to what is happening to the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. And to be attacked by two drones that caused massive damage to our ship called the Conscience, to see that while we cannot yet identify the source of the drones, there is no doubt in my mind that there is a history of violence that has been directed toward the flotillas from the state of Israel, and probably the complicity of the United States in it, and probably part of NATO, too. So we are here to stand up for the people of Gaza, for the people of the West Bank, as international humanitarians and human rights defenders when we see a genocide going on in Gaza. We have people from 22 nations. We've got young and old, and we've got people of note. We have Yvonne Ridley, who's one of the great authors. We have a very young person, Greta Thunberg, and two of her friends from Sweden who have been doing Palestine solidarity work in Sweden and wanted to be a part of this. So we have the very young, and we have the older folks, too. We have people that are from the global south, from Argentina, from Chile, from Venezuela, from Colombia, from Brazil. We have people that are all over Europe, all over in North America. So it's a good crew that we have here. Our Malaysian contingent has been here, and we've got great heart and great spirit for the people of Palestine, which is the focus of these flotillas, to bring attention to the illegal criminal acts that the state of Israel is doing on Palestine.
That was retired U.S. Colonel Anne Wright speaking in Malta about the Gaza aid flotilla that was just attacked by drones last night. I'm Amy Goodman in Baltimore with Nermeen Sheikh in New York.
Jewish Voice for Peace is holding a major conference in Baltimore this weekend. The renowned activist, author, and scholar Angela Davis spoke on Thursday night and joins us now in Baltimore. Dr. Davis is the author of many books, including Freedom is a Constant Struggle, Ferguson, Palestine, and the Foundations of a Movement. Her other books include Abolition, Feminism Now, Are Prisons Obsolete, and Women, Race, and Class. Professor Angela Davis is a distinguished professor emerita at the University of California, Santa Cruz.
Thousands of members of Jewish Voice for Peace have gathered for a weekend of workshops and plenary sessions. Dr. Angela Davis gave a keynote last night. Angela, if you could start off by talking about the history of Black, Jewish, Palestinian solidarity and why you felt it was important to address JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace.
First of all, thank you so much, Amy, for inviting me to be on the program, and thank you for your ongoing coverage. I don't know what we would do without Democracy Now. Jewish Voice for Peace has been a powerful force, since its founding, but especially in this period when we're trying to figure out how we negotiate ourselves through this horrendous combination of genocide in Gaza and on the Palestinian people more broadly, and a McCarthyist-type repression that is unfolding here in the United States, especially on the university and college campuses around the country. I think it's very important for people to recognize that as Israel represents itself as the purveyor of genocide and the forces of unfreedom, of course assisted by the United States, it is important to have a powerful force of progressive and radical Jewish people who are working in the tradition of Jewish activists who stand up not only or not primarily for their own people, but who have taught us about international solidarity and what it means to engage in struggles for freedom all over the world. So I'm really excited to be here. I should say that when I spoke last night, it was on a program with Rashida Tlaib, who's, you know, absolutely remarkable, and Omar Barghouti, who's a founding member of BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction. He was not able to attend. He was invited, but of course, neither the U.S. Nor the State of Israel wants to see him join hands with those of us here who are fighting for an end to the genocide.
Professor Davis, you've said that Palestine is a moral litmus test for the world, quoting, of course, the late poet June Jordan. You could explain why you see it as a litmus test and whether what's happened in the last a year and a half demonstrates that, in fact, the world has failed.
I thank you so much for bringing up the statement that June Jordan made about the moral litmus test that is Palestine. June Jordan is someone who fought for Palestinian solidarity at a time when the majority of people weren't listening to her. I think about her all the time, and I find myself always wishing that she could witness the surge in support of Palestine all over the country, especially on college campuses, but in trade unions and in progressive movements everywhere. So thank you very much for evoking June, which we should all be doing during this period. Palestine is really the center of the world. And as someone who's been active in the Palestine solidarity struggle for the vast majority of my life, I can say that even as we experience the unimaginable grief of witnessing an ongoing genocide, that is available in terms of being able to witness the consequences all over the world. In one sense, I want to say that This is the movement we've been struggling for decades and decades. Rashid Khalidi has this amazing book entitled The 100-Year War on Palestine. It has been, you know, 100 years. And Zionism is such a powerful force, supported, of course, by the U.S. government and its position as the leading capitalist nation state in the world. And, you know, Zionism is has had such a power that many of us have been disappointed repeatedly over and over again. How is it that people who stood up for South Africa cannot recognize that the same kind of apartheid is at work in the occupation, the Israeli occupation of Palestine? But of course, over the last period, we've seen students all over the country. As a matter of fact, all over the world. I visited a number of universities abroad, and there are, I think, on virtually every campus in the world, there are movements to expand solidarity with Palestine. So we find ourselves in a very difficult moment, a moment of grief, a moment of witnessing the apartheid and the genocide unfolding in a way that we had never imagined before. But at the same time, we recognize that Palestine has never given up. Palestine will never give up. And this is precisely why, even in the worst possible material predicament, with the Israeli bombs having destroyed virtually the entirety of Gaza, we see the Palestinian people who are refusing to give up, who will not give up on their people, who will not give up on their history, who will not give up on their culture, and who will not give up on their ability to express solidarity with other people who are struggling all over the world. And so it's a moment that is a bit difficult to digest, but I do think that even as we cry, even as we express solidarity amidst the suffering, we should recognize that this is a moment we've been waiting for, where people all over the world are recognizing Palestine as a litmus test, and are recognizing that people in the Sudan will not be successful. People in Congo will not be successful. People in Haiti will not be successful if they do not follow the leadership of the Palestinian people, who absolutely refuse to capitulate and genuflect to Zionism and to global capitalism and to racism.
I'm wondering, are you seeing a sea change at this point? The cratering of the economy, the contracting of the economy, the cratering of the polls, judge after judge ruling against Trump, and hundreds of thousands of people in the streets. What does this say to you, as you've been such a longtime activist, where we all stand now?
Well, thank you for that question, Amy. I think it is important to acknowledge that Trump was not elected by a majority of the people in this country. As a matter of fact, more people did not vote for Trump as voted than voted for him. So we're not seeing a president who, you know, has the power of the people behind him, quite the contrary. And I think that as those of us who are standing for justice and for freedom and for a better future, it's essential to recognize that we are actually in the majority, that we are on the right side of history, that we should follow the example of the Palestinian people and not give up, not succumb to the assumption that this person was elected and therefore he and his people get to dictate the direction of history. Of course, an enormous amount of damage is being done. And we know from the last administration the kind of damage that was done to the court system in this country, for which it will require untold numbers of years to recuperate from that. At the same time, I think that those of us who have been around for a long time recognize that what is happening at this moment does not dictate what is going to be happening tomorrow. Of course, the last 100 days appear to have been an eternity, and I don't think anyone has ever experienced this kind of horrendous damage being done by a person holding the executive power within such a short period of time. But at the same time, I think we should stand back and look at history and recognize that tomorrow will not be a reflection of what is happening in this moment. That, like the Palestinian people and the 100-year war against the Palestinian people, we have to hold strong. We have to engage in resistance, large acts of resistance and small acts of resistance. I am persuaded that in the end, we are the ones who are going to be able to determine the direction of history.
You have been listening to This Week in Palestine. We began our program this morning with the words of Mohsen Mahdawi in the moments after he was released from immigration detention in Vermont since mid-April. Following that, we heard a presentation from Yusef Munayyer, a presentation called Palestine in the Time of Monsters, and the discussion that followed between him and Sarah Ann Minkin at the 2025 New Jewish Left Conference, which was hosted by Boston University's Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs on February 28th. Today's show also featured interviews from Democracy Now!, including with Mary Bauer, the executive director of the ACLU of Virginia, as well as Georgetown professor Nader Hashemi, who visited an ICE jail in Texas to speak with his colleague Badr Khan Suri, a Georgetown professor who was snatched by the Trump administration back in March. Suri is married to a U.S. citizen of Palestinian background. And we heard an interview with retired U.S. Army Colonel Anne Wright, who was in Malta, waiting to board the ship carrying humanitarian aid for the Gaza Strip, which sent out a distress signal overnight, late last week, after Israeli drones bombed the flotilla in international waters near Malta. This is one of a number of flotilla over the years and years that Israel has attacked. And finally, our show is concluding with the interview that you just heard from Democracy Now! With the renowned organizer, activist, and public intellectual Angela Davis. Today is May 4th, 2025, and we are out of time for this week's installment of This Week in Palestine. If you have any questions or you would like to support us in any way, please send us an email at twippodcasts@gmail.com. I would like to thank the team that works behind the scenes to make this show happen. Bob Funk, Stan Robinson, Stephen Lowe, Professor Ann Lucas, Lish Tran, Juliet Salama Olivier, Dr. Bethany Marks, Dr. Rana Awad, Tahani Abu Mosa, and Mohammed Al-Ghul. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, currently at the home of WZBC Radio at Boston College. As always, we thank you for spending time with us as we continue to work for Palestinian liberation. Until next time, peace.